Talking History on News Talk.
Well, good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we have a very special one for you indeed. We're exploring the life and legacy of the enigmatic Dutch genius Rembrandt, and we'll be finding out how he became one of the world's best-loved artists. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just send us a text on 53106. Text costs 30 cents, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we explored China's Cultural Revolution, assessed the legacy of the Irish Parliamentary Party in independent Ireland, and followed the journey of the Mayflower in our second June book show. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or wherever you download your podcasts. In tonight's show, we're debating the life and legacy of Rembrandt. Born in Leiden in the Netherlands in 1606, Rembrandt van Rijn has been called an enigmatic legend, a rebel, an ordinary man, and an extraordinary genius. As an artist, he painted works of haunting complexity, praised for their astonishing brushwork and deep compassion, and he is considered the greatest artist of his country's golden age. His masterpieces included The Night Watch, and in a career of highs and lows, he achieved great success, but also went bankrupt. He died in October 1669 in Amsterdam and was buried in an unmarked grave. Today, Rembrandt is one of the world's most popular artists, loved for his ability to capture the emotional heart of any character or story. And so in tonight's show, we want to explore his life, his work, and his legacy. And to help me do that, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Leonor van Sluyten is the curator at the Rembrandt House in Amsterdam and is the author of Rembrandt's Late Pupils, Studying Under a Genius. Jan Six is an art historian and art dealer who unearthed a previously unknown painting by Rembrandt in November 2016. And he's a direct descendant of the Jan Six, who was a friend of Rembrandt and had his portrait painted by him. Mark O'Kelly is an artist and the head of painting at NCAD and is a member of the Arts Council and is also involved in art education. Dr. Jonathan Bicker is an acclaimed Rembrandt scholar and is the research curator at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, and he's the author of Rembrandt, Biography of a Rebel. Well, you're all very welcome, and later in the show I'll also be talking to Anne Baudair, who is one of the curators of exhibition at the Crawford Art Gallery in Cork and is involved in bringing the Rembrandt in print exhibition to Ireland. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome. And Mark, could I begin with you and maybe a question about what is it that's unique about Rembrandt?
Sure, Patrick. Rembrandt's a completely unique artist. In fact, if we were to distill down some of the achievement to a very simple comment, we could say that ultimately his painting does something technically that other painters have never matched. And that would be in the combination of chiaroscuro and particularly intense impasto painting. And this is technically a very profound achievement in his work. If we think of an artist like Leonardo da Vinci, we think of him as the preeminent artist. But in a way, we think of Leonardo's accomplishment of painting as a kind of a failure, unfinished works, the crumbling surface of the Last Supper. In Rembrandt's work, instead, we think about this as par excellence in terms of painting, and the materiality of paint and its earthiness comes to the fore. So there's a deeply humane, earthy and real tradition that Rembrandt advances in his career that comes out of the Protestant Reformation and the work of juror and observation from life. So I think this is what's really critical about Rembrandt. But also Rembrandt, in a way, really invents the concept that we associate today of the contemporary artist, because the studio itself as a site, a function and a theme, the notion of invention that takes place in the studio. Rembrandt has his subjects perform roles. So it's kind of a performance of portraiture in which they take on roles, much like a theatre director. And the site of this becomes the studio. And this concept of the artist alone in the studio and the existential implications of that, that we could see in the 20th century in the work of someone like Lucian Freud or perhaps Courbet in the 19th century, all of this really has its origins, this cult of the artist as outsider, as if you like, somebody who wrestles with the material and phenomenological existential problems of matter. This really originates in the work of Rembrandt.
It's very interesting, Jonathan, listening to Mark there, because he mentioned a theatre director, and that is one thing that I came across a lot reading about Rembrandt, that he was a great storyteller, and the way he approached these, whether it was a portrait or a larger scene, that he almost had a film director's eye in the way he was able to tell a story with his art.
Yeah, you could say that. And Janis often said that if Rembrandt lived today, he would be a film director. And he was fascinated by stories and storytelling. That is the major stories, biblical stories and mythological stories. That was the most important task of an artist in his day. And Rembrandt proved that he was the master of all masters as far as storytelling on that high level is concerned. And he often brought into he would never simply repeat a story in paint or in an etching that had that other artists had done, but he always looks for a different moment, the most pregnant moment of a story. And would show that, or he would show stories that had never been painted before by any other artist, and he couldn't stop telling stories. Even his portraits. One of the most remarkable thing about his group portraits is that they're not portraits. They're actually they're history paintings. That is, they try and tell a story. And that includes the Night Watch as well, which makes it one of the most special paintings of the 17th century.
And Leonor, it's interesting when you look at his collected works that I think it's something like 300 or so paintings, 290 etchings, 2,000 drawings. It's an incredible portfolio of work that he has.
Yeah, that's true. The production has been incredibly high. A tiny correction as for the drawings. Produced so much also in his style by pupils, and as for the drawings goes, of all these 2,000 drawings that were once named Rembrandt, nowadays we think of some 700 drawings as really by the hand of Rembrandt, and the rest done by pupils. But nevertheless, it is an incredible oeuvre, and it varies in so many different genres and techniques. Even within the drawings, it's incredible how many different techniques and tools he used, and how he was constantly searching for different ways of expressing what he was trying to put onto paper or canvas.
Jan, what was it like to, well, first of all, what was it like growing up to have this incredible connection to Rembrandt, and then to be involved in this major discovery?
Well, growing up like any other person, because we didn't really live with the Rembrandts day to day. The house was, luckily the house wasn't set up that we were constantly in contact. But I mean, from the age of 16, 17, I started to realize that it was special, and it probably was a catalyst for me to go into art. To be able to discover paintings by him is a dream, absolute dream.
And what do you think is so great about him as an artist? Like, why you can, for someone who doesn't know Rembrandt's works and might only know one or two of the images, mightn't know any. What is it that you would say should encourage them to look at his artworks? What is it that makes him such a widely loved and universally loved artist?
Well, I think that's something for each of us to decide for themselves. But what happens when I walk through a museum is that most of the portraits that will be hanging around by any artist will sort of catch my attention, but briefly. But whenever you walk past a Rembrandt, even if you go quite fast, you sort of stop and you look back, because especially with his portraits, he has this ability to catch you. And I always sense that the sitters are looking at me instead of me looking at the sitters. There's this instant connection, because Rembrandt had the ability, some authors brought down, it is a sort of a psychological insight in the sitters, but he had the ability to really paint the people. instead of an image of the person standing in front of him. And so you're captured. And if you're sensitive and you can see that, it really is so different than any other portraitist.
Very interesting, Mark. And when we look at the life then, that's something as well, that the life, it seems to have so many contradictions and so many mysteries as well, that it's not a straightforward life story.
The life is tragic in many accounts, and Rembrandt's early ambition is very strong, and he belongs in a context with a compatriot, Jan Leavens, who are very ambitious, and they move to Amsterdam quite young after a very early apprenticeship, when he moves from really in his family being really moved towards becoming maybe a clerical worker, a middle class clerk. He leaves college and he begins to seek out training as an artist, but he's extremely ambitious. And in some ways, I think in the middle of his career, after the early success of the anatomy lesson of Dr. Chulp, he almost fluffs his lines when it comes to mid-career, when he gets his big opportunity with the series of paintings around the passions. It's quite drawn out, and the Baroque effect, the kind of almost supernatural special effects that the work features, in some ways this is not substantiated in a way by further commissions of that sort. And that's where his career kind of goes almost into this other, more introspective phase, and this kind of analysis of character and this psychology of person is very interesting. I think his double portraits as well are quite phenomenal in how he makes an image, not just of a person, but of a whole set of relationships. There's a painting of a preacher called, I can't remember his name, and his wife, and it's almost like an image, an early image of a kind of almost like mansplaining moment. It's the portrait of a Mennonite preacher and his wife, Cornelius Claesus, and his wife, and Cornelius indicates at the book where she sits with her hands curled in her lap, carefully listening to her husband as he points towards the book. The materiality in Rembrandt's work, the tactileness of books and metals and all sorts of forms of tactile objects, also is a very sensuous and very real occurrence. And Rembrandt, all of this is deeply lived. He collects all these objects, and then tragically, all of these things leave his home when he becomes bankrupt and he is dispossessed of this collection. So the life is almost, I think, when we look at the history of his pictures, we can see this life refracted in his work, in the figure of Bathsheba in later on in 1664. His common law wife, Henrica, is pictured as Bathsheba. And of course, this portrait has biographical connotations in terms of the story of Bathsheba and her relationship with King David. So all through his work, there's a kind of a double play going on, I think, in that he's narrating the subject, but also onto it, I think we can also project and understand a lot of the trauma of and success and highs and lows of Rembrandt's own existence.
Leonora, it's hard to maybe get a handle on his personality, that he seems to have been quite curious, quite confident. He definitely seems to have changed and evolved as he developed. But it does seem that there is a kind of an enigma at the heart of his character.
Yeah, well, it's always difficult to sort of reconstruct a personality of a man who we have never spoken to. And unlike Vincent van Gogh, he was not much of a writer. So unfortunately, we have little to go with. The letters we do have, 7 letters written to Constant and Huygens, they show sort of a lack of diplomatic talent. But they also show a man who is so strong and confident about his artistic ability and about his opinions. And we also know of a few incidents in which Rembrandt defends his case without avoiding getting into any conflict. You might say, I think he was a man with a very strong character, very strong personality, but also very able to feel empathy. Because if you look at his art, especially his etchings and his drawings, in my opinion, it is an ocean of trying, a world in which he tries to understand and show the emotions and the feelings people, but even animals, he portrays. on the sheet of paper. It's and that to me shows that he was a man with a great ability to feel empathy.
And Leonor, it's interesting because we think of him primarily as an artist, but he was also, by all accounts, an inspirational teacher. He was a collector. He was an entrepreneur. That there were all these other dimensions to him as well.
Absolutely, and that is so wonderful in our museum, which consists partly in the living house, the house in which he lived for almost 20 years in Amsterdam. And in walking through this house, you can really experience all the different aspects of his daily life, and that makes him more of a whole person to understand and to grasp. And indeed, he was a very inspirational teacher. He taught many pupils. We know of some 40 names. They mainly came to him to learn to draw and paint in his style and to be educated in his ideas about art also. But they also collaborated in producing works of art that could be sold from the studio. So a very diverse scale of activities, indeed.
Very good. Okay, well, tonight we are debating the life, work and legacy of Rembrandt. We're going to take a very quick break now. When we're going to come back, we're going to explore the highs and lows of his career and discuss some of his most famous works. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life, work and legacy of Rembrandt. We're joined by Leonor von Slauten, Jan Six, Mark O'Kelly and Dr. Jonathan Bicker. Mark, can we talk about the self-portraits of Rembrandt? Because you see, I think, the evolution of his character with those as well, and you get an insight into him as an artist, but also his humanity.
Definitely. In the late 1620s, for example, we see an extraordinary moment about 1629 when he makes these very interesting up-close self-portraits. We just see the top of his collar, his eyes bathed in darkness and his curly mop of hair. There's also etchings like this. So this is a kind of almost like, he almost looks like an upstart, a farmer, a boy, a peasant. In other portraits, we see him depicting himself as Saint Paul later on. Most famously as the prodigal son, a very important painting that he has with Saskia sitting on his knee, almost like a courtesan. He's holding a glass into the air. I suppose we think about things today like self-portraits. We think about selfies. We think about this image of the self as something that changes and evolves. That's a very contemporary idea. In Rembrandt's work, he does this. He dons a gold chain. He paints himself as a king. He's aware of the angles looking up at him, hunkering down in those early works. At every point, he's projecting an image of character, but also in some way playing into stereotypes too. This caricature that's in his work is very interesting, coming out of the etchings. You could say, in some ways, in the 20th century, the cartoonist Robert Crumb, the West Coast American cartoonist, became famous in the late 60s, very controversial cartoonist. This hatching style of his is very interesting in terms of what has become part of the satirical language, I suppose, of like political cartooning. But in Rembrandt's work, this element of cartooning and caricature is always present, is always highly expressive, and that's something that's narrated throughout his work. And the self-portrait very definitely gives us an idea of an evolving, changing character, becoming increasingly introspective towards the end of his life. His very last self-portrait, painted in the year of his death, is a particularly sobering example of this. He's almost dressed in rags with a very small, almost like wrapped cloth in his head. His hands are clasped together in a moment of reticence and almost psychological acceptance. It's a very realistic and it's a very down-to-earth piece of work that's full of empathy.
And Jonathan, I wonder, would you be able to talk to us about one of his most famous works and one of the great masterpieces of the age, The Night Watch, because there you see all the evidence of him as a great innovator.
Yeah, and you could say that that's the climax of the first half of his career. It was, there were a lot of these, that type of portrait. It's actually a portrait, The Night Watch, that were made in the 17th century. I think there were 52 altogether that were made in Amsterdam. And this is the only commission that Rembrandt got for such a painting. And usually these are just actually a pupil of his that later made fun of the painting that was that hung next to it in the same room and was executed in the same year, 1642. And there you see all the men just lined up in a row. And it's as if you could take a knife and in one fell swoop decapitate all of them. So they're static and they're doing nothing. They're just being there to standing there to be have their portrait painted. But Rembrandt just throws that out out of the window and goes his own way and makes a drama out of it. Sets the figures into action. There are only 18 civic guardsmen in the painting, but 34 figures altogether. So we have all these extras that are dressed in exotic costumes. They're not dressed in 17th century clothing, all of the figures. A lot of them are dressed in 16th century clothing, and his contemporaries would have known that. And then he gives them all manner of weaponry. And the first musket is shot in that painting. So Rembrandt makes a hell of a lot more out of it than basically all other artists who had worked in that genre.
And it's fascinating. Your book is that your acclaimed study is Biography of a Rebel. Talk to me about the elements of him that where we see that rebel in action.
Yeah, well, The Night Watch is one of those instances where he takes a genre and instead of doing what everybody else does, he turns it on its head and does something completely different. But yeah, he was a rebel. Nobody in his own day called him that, but he was called the first heretic in art by one of his contemporaries not too long after his death, and others did say that he broke the rules of art. And one of the rules of art was already alluded to by Mark, was that thick impasto. One critic said of his work that he that it was laid on like with a bricklayer's trowel, and if you got if you laid it down on the floor, you could. There was a portrait by a man that was so thickly painted that if you put it on the ground, you could lift it up by the nose of the figure. These were very, his use of the palette knife, for example, these are techniques that were against the classical rules of art, and also his concept of beauty. He threw that out of the window. He wasn't concerned at all with idealized female nudes. If he depicted a nude, there's a very famous etching of 1631. And if anybody looks at it today, we think automatically that it's ugly. And then we start thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe in Rembrandt's time, this was considered beautiful, all that cellulite. But I don't think that's the case at all. I think Rembrandt also thought that the subject wasn't particularly beautiful, but all that folds of flesh and wrinkles, that was a great playground for light and dark, for art. It was a beautiful work of art. The subject wasn't necessarily beautiful.
And Jonathan, it's interesting. We know quite a lot about his private life. We know about his marriage. His wife died. I think there was a difficulty in remarrying legally, or he would have lost a trust funds for his son Titus. So he had a common law wife. And you get a kind of an insight into his character from some of those difficulties.
I actually think there's a big break in his life and career, and that's in 1642. That's the year that he finishes the Night Watch. And we know that painting I was talking about that hung next to it, we know that that was delivered on the 16th of July, 1642. And Rembrandt might have had the same delivery date. If that was the case, he probably had a very, very hard time of it, because only a month earlier, his wife, Saskia Aulenburg, who was just shy of her 30th birthday, died. And Rembrandt was left with the 8-month-old Titus. and I think he goes through, he has a breakdown. And to the next 9 years, he doesn't paint almost anything. And I think that that he reevaluates life, and he starts doing only what he wants to do. One of those things, I think, was teaching, which was also a source of income. But I think he enjoyed doing that. He had a lot of pupils in the 1640s. He also enjoyed making walks in the countryside. And lots of sketches, and also 23 landscape etchings were made in this period. And then the other thing was collecting, which he did a lot of.
Very good.
In this period.
Jan, I want to bring you in on some of the highs and lows of his career, because there is that sense that, looking at it, that at, for some periods he had great success, or he certainly seemed to be getting a lot of commissions, and there were a lot of very well-off patrons who wanted to purchase his works. But then it also seems that debt was a constant worry, and sometimes he was struggling to avoid bankruptcy, and he was having to sell off collections. So it seems that money was a tricky matter for him throughout the career.
Well, indeed, it seems like that. And the as Leonor pointed out earlier, the little that we actually do know about how he conducted affairs. Because we don't have his ledgers, we don't have his financial bookkeeping, we don't really know how and what he spent. We do know what he lent sometimes, and that he got himself into trouble sometimes. But I don't know. I mean, I've always wondered, if I die, you look in my desk, you find some files, but can you really reconstruct my life from these files? Probably not. So, because we don't have everything, in a way, we should also be aware that it is still sort of an enigma. And due to the very few things that we do have, we built this sort of sometimes romantic view of Rembrandt's life. And I'm always a little bit hesitant, because you never know what we might find in archives or, you know, in other sources that might turn up in the future.
That's very interesting, and we have the exact same issue when we cover a composer on the show, that sometimes people read into the biography elements that they draw from the music, and if the music is tragic or melodramatic, then they kind of assume that the composer had these elements in their life, where they reinterpret some aspects of the life influenced by that. And is there a possibility that you could do the same with Rembrandt based on the art? And that kind of shapes or reshapes how you view the life?
Well, I mean, there was a very nice example that we always thought that Rembrandt as a youngster left school early. And then one year ago, somebody found in the Leiden archives that he actually went another extra year to school. And, you know, the archives for the other years are gone, so we don't really know, but it might actually be possible that he spent more time at school. And I remember that came to the news, and I was so happy, because I could never really understand why Rembrandt has such great knowledge about the classical text and about all the, you know, he had so many intellectual friends, and his subjects are so, you know, difficult, and he must have had, you know, he must have been quite a clever guy. Then to think that he left school early didn't really make sense. And then finally you find a source, and you can bit by bit prove that actually it was slightly different. And that, of course, changes a lot. So I don't know what we'll find in the future, but I'm just hoping that we'll find a lot more to get a better feel of how his life actually went.
Very good. Mark, it is an interesting relationship, isn't it? The biography and the art and the relationship between the two.
Yeah, and it's curious to talk about painting on the radio because we kind of look at the paintings, but I do feel in a way there is a kind of ongoing self-conscious narrative taking place in the paintings. I do think the paintings constitute a kind of a biographical text in a way. I feel very strongly about that, and I think it's in the work. You know, I think there is something going on there in the work. How Rembrandt meets the gaze, returns the gaze, and is very aware of the viewer. I almost think his work is designed to anticipate the viewer. One example of this, I think, is in the early painting, which is the sacrifice of Isaac. There's an extraordinary thing in that painting because Abraham is not actually holding the dagger. The dagger is in midair. It's an example of stop motion animation. He knows, it's as if he understands that the viewer will cognitively put the moments together. So it's almost like in Rembrandt's painting, there's moments suffused together. And go back to the Night Watch. It's as if it's before the director shouts, film or begin. It's almost like they're getting ready to commence. So Rembrandt's always looking to the margins. And again, in some of the paintings, there's some extraordinary extra pieces, almost an excess of information. In the etching, the Good Samaritan, there is a dog in the foreground who's actually taking a crap. It's this kind of detail in Rembrandt's work, this kind of extraordinary, observation of the, what could be the banality or the minutiae of life as well, that, makes you understand there's something else being communicated besides the ostensible main subject of the work. In the Night Watch, there's a female figure carrying a chicken, and things like this, these kind of extraordinary moments that happen, which are inexplicable, but also point outside of the frame of the painting to the life and to the experience of life as it is lived, I think.
Leonor, it's interesting. I met a friend last night who I hadn't seen in many, many months because of all of the things we have been through as a country and as a world. And when I said I was doing tonight's show on Rembrandt, he said, "Oh, well, the key place is the Rembrandt House." And I think he had made a trip to Amsterdam specially to go and visit it. And when I said that I had you on, he was hugely impressed. So, can you tell our listeners about the Rembrandt House and what a visitor would see there?
Ah, well, that's a great compliment. I'm very happy to hear this. We are a small museum, but a very special one, a very unique one of all the five addresses Rembrandt inhabited in Amsterdam and also the house in Leiden. This is the only house which still exists. And it's also sort of by miracle. So our museum consists nowadays in three parts, an office building and a modern museum wing. But of course, the main building is the former living house of Rembrandt. Rembrandt bought the house in the period in which he got the order, the commission for the Night Watch. Saskia dies in the house. Titus is born in the house. Cornelia is born in the house, the daughter of Rembrandt and Hendrikje. And in the end, after almost 20 years, in 1658, he has to move out with Hendrikje and Titus and Cornelia because he has this unfortunate situation of this personal bankruptcy. So the house sort of portrays a very important midsection in his life, in his biography. Of course, the house has been transformed in different, it was rebuilt inside also, it was divided into two houses, and it was sort of by miracle that the house is still there. And it was around 1900 that a group of artists and Rembrandt lovers decided that it was very important to keep this house for the future, and that is how the history of our museum started. And it was actually only at the end of the last century, so in 1999, that we could reopen the museum after a large refurbishment. And what you see now when you visit the museum is a reconstruction of the way Rembrandt must have lived in that house. And this is very special because we could do that at hand of an amazing source, this inventory list, which was drawn up in 1656 when Rembrandt went bankrupt. He walked together with one or two people from the city government through the house, and he dictated what was hanging where, on which wall, in which room, and at hand of that source, which is kept in the city archive in Amsterdam and still there, we know in very detail how the house was decorated and what the rooms were used for, what the function was, what names the rooms had. So it is an amazing experience. I still find that after having been working there for so many years, but it's so special to be able to visit a house of a 17th century artist. Of course, in Belgium, you can visit the Rubens house, and we have the Rembrandt house in the Netherlands. And it is already such a wonderful experience to walk into his studio and to experience the infalling light, which has not changed over four centuries, and to sort of imagine how he must have worked in that room, and how also to understand how light was part of his daily occupation. We could use also drawings he made in the house, the living room, where which was also their bedroom. For example, in Paris, a wonderful drawing is still kept, where we see Saskia in bed, and you see what kind of bed there was and what kind of chairs were standing around the bed. And all these kind of sources we used to reconstruct the interior of the house, and also the art room. Rembrandt was a vast collector, a passionate collector, and he really had a mini museum in his house. This Kunst und Wunderkammer, this room with rarities, with animals, with Venetian glass, with corals, with shells, with object of art, object of nature, exotic objects, but also piles of albums with drawings and prints of artists he admired, which he collected and used also to be inspired to do it even better.
Very good. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, I'll be talking to Anne Baudet about the exhibition that's going to be coming to the Crawford Art Gallery in Cork soon. And we'll also be assessing the legacy of Rembrandt.
Talking History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life, work and legacy of Rembrandt. I'm delighted to be joined now by Anne Baudet, who's one of the creators of exhibition at the Crawford Art Gallery in Cork. And she's involved in bringing the Rembrandt in print exhibition to Ireland, something that has been rescheduled because of the recent pandemic, but it will happen. Anne, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
And it's very interesting because, again, it's an aspect of Rembrandt that people may not be as familiar with, that the fact that he was this innovative and experimental printmaker as well.
Indeed. Rembrandt was obviously, or is obviously, known as a wonderful painter and unique and genius in painting, but he also was extremely experimental and was making his own prints, which would be quite unusual. Often artists would have been using printmakers, you know, professional or distinct printmakers, to make reproductions from artworks, from drawings or paintings that they would have done, whereas Rembrandt was himself experimenting. So we will be extremely privileged to show in Cork about 50 of the works from the collection of the Ashmolean Museum. The exhibition was put together by their curator, Anne Van Camp. And as you said, we are really grateful that they've agreed to postpone the exhibition, and we will be showing it from February next year.
And what insights do we get into Rembrandt from looking at these works? Is it what we've been talking about earlier, Rembrandt as a storyteller, as an innovator, as someone who's doing things in a new and different way?
Yes, all of the above, very much so. Whether through his self-portraits and family portraits or his genre paintings, you can catch a glimpse of his observational skills and of his desire to show things warts and all, of his talent, playful nature as well. I think when you look at one of the etching that we will be showing, which is quite a famous one entitled Three Trees, and you know, initially you think, oh, it's a landscape. And then when you look closer, you see a couple embracing, or you see people, two fishermen. It's going to be really good. The other thing is, I mean, the prowess, obviously, it's incredible when you look at to be able to have such a detail on such a tiny scale for some of the work. That has to be, a show of his genius, really.
Very interesting. Mark, it's interesting the way Rembrandt has resonated throughout the centuries, and with every generation, he seems to have a cultural impact.
It seems to have much more significance, when we come into the 20th century. He seems to be so relevant today in the world, and I think that Rembrandt has that kind of status. Subliminally, I imagine we encounter something Rembrandt-esque every day of our lives. It's so ingrained, I think, the language of his work in our culture. Think about even a film like The Godfather, and thinking about people in half-lit rooms instructing each other in kind of very blank, anonymous suited clothing. I think of the sampling officials of the Drapers Guild, his masterpiece from 1662, when a group of men are peering over a table down at us, and we are the kind of, if you like, the interrogated subject of the work. I think about the TV show Friends with the theme tune of I'll be there for you, that's played all over the world when the show is watched every day. But of course, that band is called the Rembrandts. And then we think about this idea of empathy, of somebody being there, this kind of, if you like, loyalty, you know, that's symbolized by the dogs, maybe, again, in Rembrandt's work, or if you like, this set of relationships that's narrated through his work, people living together in this kind of household. Almost today, we call them what, a little germ pot, a little bubble, himself and Saskia and Titus and Henrika and these characters that surround him in his life. We think of these as a cast of characters. So Rembrandt very much inhabits our imagination, and he's a vehicle for our own, if you like, projected fantasies of betterment or change or transformation. He pictures himself as an oriental costume based upon a figure from Rubens' painting, and curiously enough, he adds a huge poodle to the foreground a number of years later. This kind of characterization, this kind of playing around and inventing of identities, I think that it's very relevant to our culture today. And I think that this kind of, if you like, half-turned face, this kind of meeting our gaze in a half-lit light, this is very much part of the culture of advertising, and very much part of the culture in which we're engaged with, I suppose, in the mediated world of the 21st century.
Leonore, I'm interested in what you think his great legacy is.
Whoa, that is a big question. What his legacy is? Well, his legacy is, of course, his work, and the way people can still today and tomorrow and yesterday relate to it and find something of themselves maybe in it. It's a timeless oeuvre, in my opinion, and it gives so many opportunities to look at it from different angles and to learn something about it and about yourself.
And Jonathan, I think in a way that's a message that's even more important for us in the year 2020 than perhaps any other year in recent decades. And there is something about great art that inspires us, and that it makes us think about ourselves differently and the world differently. And is that what Rembrandt was able to do better than most other artists? He was able to create images that were able to transfix and inspire people for centuries afterwards.
I think Rembrandt was the first artist and the greatest artist to allow us to experience our humanity. And I think he did that because he was preoccupied with showing what was called at the time the passions of the soul. He plumbed the deepest depths of our souls and showed our most raw emotions and the greatest variety of human emotions. And it is our emotions which distinguish us as human beings and not mere animals. And so I think when you look at Rembrandt's art, a great deal of the appeal is that you are experiencing your own humanity.
Very good. And Jan, for our listeners tonight, or who, whenever our listeners are maybe downloading this show as a podcast and playing it back, if they want to go online and look at some Rembrandt paintings until the day when they will be able to visit these great museums and houses in the months and years to come, what pieces of art, what works should you encourage them to look at first?
Well, what I always do is I go to the Rijksmuseum website, because I think they have one of the best websites available. You can really zoom in, and not a long time ago they've actually uploaded a image of the Night Watch, which is so incredibly precise that I spent hours, literally hours, looking through that picture, because you can zoom in on highlights within the iris of an eye. So my first advice is go to the Rijksmuseum website. There are hundreds of images of etchings, drawings, and paintings, and it's absolutely remarkable.
And Jan, what would be your insight on the great legacy of Rembrandt?
Well, you know, I'm an old master paintings person. I love the past. And I think that Mondrian and Van Gogh are far too new for my taste. So I'm always very happy that Rembrandt put Holland on the map. And I like tulips, and I like clogs, and I like all other Dutch stuff, but I'm really proud of Rembrandt. And I'm pretty sure that nearly everybody in the world will know Holland due to Rembrandt. So that makes me really happy.
I find myself almost getting emotional on tonight's show with the comments, and I suppose the how much this means to so many people, and the fact that it has that enduring power and inspires such awe, and it resonates. And Mark, it'll be the case that in 100 years, in 300 years, in 1,000 years, the work of Rembrandt will continue to do that.
I think there's no doubt about that. I think that the other thing that's very important, I suppose, is that what Rembrandt also establishes, I suppose, is the modern world in terms of Amsterdam being the city it was. New York, of course, became the new Amsterdam, and the origins, I suppose, of the world we live in today, in terms of like the consumer world, the world of commodities, of exotic goods from other places. All of these things informed Rembrandt's position. So as long as there will be international global trade and new innovations in science and engineering and new metals and new forms, new science, Rembrandt will be right there as the first real documentarian of this huge shift in European and world culture.
Yeah, well, I have to say, we've done many shows on composers, and it's always easy with composers because you can play some of the music and it brings it to life. But it's much more difficult to do that with an artist. And our panel tonight have been absolutely brilliant because they have brought the life, the work of Rembrandt to life. And it just encourages us all to go and visit these museums when we can, and to look at the artwork. And I think they've done an absolutely wonderful job. My thanks to them all. Leonor van Slouten, the creator of the Rembrandt House in Amsterdam, Jan Six, the brilliant art historian and art dealer, Mark O'Kelly of NCAD, Dr. Jonathan Vicker of the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, he's the research curator there, also his wonderful book Rembrandt Biography of a Rebel, and of course Anne Vodar, who's one of the creators of exhibition at the Crawford Art Gallery in Cork. And keep an eye out for that Rembrandt in print exhibition that will be coming. Well, my thanks to all my guests for bringing Rembrandt to life tonight. My thanks also to my brilliant producer Susan Cahill, to Niamh McGee on research, and to Paul Murnock on sound. Next week we'll be searching for the lost city of Solomon, revisiting the debacle of Irish water, and exploring law and revolution in 17th century Ireland, and lots more besides. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.